This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Men's Hour, brought to you by Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Our first stories are coming to us from Billboard magazine, dated July 17th. And this first article is about two of the probably most famous rock stars on the planet, who are also probably close to the oldest as well. Time is on their side. At 82, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards are as vital and creative as ever. With a new Rolling Stones album just out, the yin and yang of rock open up about touring, AI, and why their partnership still works. Under a poolside canopy in West London, Mick Jagger offers me a tongue-in-cheek choice as we sit down. Should I be polite in English or shall I be rude and New York-like? The English rocker, who lived in New York for 18 years and was knighted in 2003, is smirking, but one gets the impression he could readily slide into either mode. The Rolling Stones frontman can code switch in a jumpin' jack flash, talking as comfortably about physics and aviation as pop stars and bluesmen. 48 hours later, when I sit down with Keith Richards in a Manhattan jazz club for a separate chat, he offers no such options. Keith is simply Keith, that's K-E-E-F. If the 82-year-old Jagger is polished and detail-oriented, he gives feedback on the placement of our chairs relative to the camera filming our conversation and notes that an overhead airplane must be old-fashioned because he can hear its propeller. Richards, also 82, is relaxed and slyly mischievous, full of rumbling chuckles and one-liners about everything from smartphones, I feel Toy Town eludes me, to his grandchildren. There's these little creatures rolling around that sort of vaguely remind you of somebody. They may share an obsession with American blues and R&B, but the Glimmer Twins are far from identical. And since their debut recording 63 years ago, that oil and water alchemy has fueled the greatest rock and roll band in the world. While the Stones started out as a rhythm and blues covers band steered by guitarist Brian Jones, the songwriting tandem of singer Jagger and guitarist Richards, which began when then-manager Andrew Loog Oldman demanded they write their own material to keep up pace with the Beatles, soon became the Stones' not-so-secret weapon. As Chuck Berry acolytes, Jagger and Richards mastered the art of biting rock brevity, releasing a string of genre-hopping. Five of their eight Billboard Hot 100 chart toppers came between 1965 and 1969 that made them stars on both sides of the Atlantic and inspired a generation of rockers, garage, punk, country, and beyond, from Croydon to California. But success came with casualties. In July 1969, Jones was found dead in his swimming pool at 27, weeks after a meeting with Jagger, Richards, and drummer Charlie Watts about his drug abuse led to him leaving the group. Months after, a woman was fatally stabbed during the band's concert at the Altamont Free Festival, later cited as the moment when the optimism of the 60s came crashing down. Tumult continued in the 70s. Mick Taylor, Jones' replacement, was in turn supplanted in 1975 by Ronnie Wood, who has remained a member since. The group weathered drug-related arrests, went into tax exile from the United Kingdom, and filed suit against former manager Alan Klein for allegedly fraudulent practices. The band settled with Klein in 1984. Those legal headaches didn't quash creativity or commercial success. If anything, the me decade is when the Stones codified their distinctive style. Sleazy, bluesy, and boozy rock, presided over by Jagger's insouciant sneer and Richards' roguish grin on landmark albums including Sticky Fingers in 71, Exile on Main Street in 72, and Some Girls in 1978. On the business side, the launch of the now-defunct Rolling Stone Records label in 1970 produced the iconic Lips and Tongue logo and signaled the band's efforts to take control of its recordings, finances, and future. In 1986, a full 9 years before winning a competitive Grammy, the Stones received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Recording Academy. But the elder statesmen of rough and tumble rock weren't done blazing trails. Sniffing out opportunity, the Stones partnered up with fragrance maker Jovan on their 1981 tour, receiving several million dollars to offset production costs. The 1989-90 Steel Wheels tour tour, promoted by the legendary Michael Cole, changed how tours were staged and financed, upping the ante on immersive stage designs and establishing new norms for the touring biz, corporate sponsors, and merchandise aplenty that continue to this day. From then on, the Stones remained a road juggernaut, grossing $2.9 billion and selling 28.9 million tickets dating back to Steel Wheels, according to Billboard Box Score. The band's 2024 track alone earned $235 million and sold 848,000 tickets across 18 shows, marking the band's fifth consecutive tour to average at least 45,000 tickets per night. The days of manager drama are behind them, too. Joyce Smith, who entered the group's orbit as part of its legal team, has been the band's manager since 2010. Jane Rose manages Richards, and Pia Squilino serves as Jagger's business executive. But despite their plentiful live shows, there's been a comparative dearth of new Stone songs in the 21st century. 2023's Hackney Diamonds was the first Stones album of original material since 2005's A Bigger Bang. Although the band had been knocking around material for years, it needed a push over the finish line. About a year after Charlie Watts died in 2021 at age 80, Paul McCartney suggested while dining with Wood that the band give producer Andrew Watt, now a bit of a studio specialist with veteran rock acts from Ozzy Osbourne to Pearl Jam, a shot. The next day, Wood spoke to Jagger and learned Watt's name was at the top of a list of producers the frontman was considering. "So we tried this young whippersnapper," Wood, speaking over the phone from London, recounts the week after I meet Jagger and Richards. According to the guitarist, who joined the band 51 years ago but remains its newest member, Watt helped keep them on task. Keith would say, "I'll do my guitar next week." "No, you'll do it now." The producer's deft musicianship ensured the Stones took him seriously. "He's a great guitarist. He can play my parts better than I can," Wood jokes. Hackney Diamonds debuted at number 3 on the Billboard 200, becoming their 38th top 10 set, and it later won the Grammy Award for Best Rock Album, and this time they didn't have to wait 18 years for a follow-up. Drawing on unfinished material from the Hackney Diamonds sessions, the Stones reunited with Watt for Foreign Tongues, a 14-track album that dropped July 10th on Polydor Capital, their label home since the 2016 covers album Blue and Lonesome. Boasting low-key guest spots from McCartney, The Cure's Robert Smith, Red Hot Chili Peppers' Chad Smith, and Bruno Mars, Foreign Tongues pairs pointed, often political lyrics with ass-shaking rock, Mr. Charm, Divine Intervention, Chicago Blues, Rough and Twisted, and Country Pastiche, Ringing Hollow. Mick is very focused on the grooves, the BPM, the chord movement, the accents, says Watt, 35. Keith is able to weave poetry out of that, taking something Mick started and making a riff everyone's going to hang on to, a melodic phrase so catchy it becomes the hook of the song. It adds up to a robust, potent album that punches harder than its predecessor and slaps down the idea that aging artists need to be nostalgic. Even on different sides of the Atlantic, the duo's yin-yang chemistry is palpable. Fielding similar questions, Jagger and Richards start from disparate places but frequently arrive at simpatico conclusions. They are sublimely mismatched. "They're absolutely incredible together," Watt says of their in-studio chemistry. "There's no Mick song that's not better with Keith in it, and there's no Keith song that's not better with Mick in it. They complete each other. It's unbelievable to watch and learn from. They build and they play to each other's heartbeats, and the roof leaves the building." Here are the Q&As. How much of Foreign Tongues grew out of the Hackney Diamonds sessions? Mick Jagger: "We had, from Hackney Diamonds, three songs we didn't put on purposely because we knew we wanted to save them. We always planned that we were going to do another album pretty quick." Keith Richards: "I feel like Foreign Tongues is a continuation of Hackney Diamonds. Not so much songs as the energy and the feel of it. As happens with Mick and me occasionally, we don't see each other for a while. Then somehow when we get together and say, 'Well, what do you got? Oh, that bit fits with this,' in a way we're writing the same song without knowing it on the other side of the globe." Jagger: "Keith did a really nice riff on Mr. Charm that was better than the one I'd originally written, which is his job, to do my riff, only better." How does Ronnie fit into it? Richards: "Ronnie listens with an eagle ear. And then suddenly comes up with, what if I do this? Perfect. I call it the ancient form of weaving. That's what we do. That's also, to me, the other fun part of it. I don't know what Ronnie's going to come up with. You're watching this thing grow in front of your ears. There's a bite to these songs. Where does that come from? Richards, that's a tough one to answer. At different times in my career, I could give you very different answers. Energy. I don't know whether it's a matter of enthusiasm and you go through waves of this. I think a lot of it also had to do with the fact that we really wanted to get this rhythm section of Steve and Daryl, that's Jordan, who subbed for Watts and on the band's 21 tour and currently serves as its drummer, and Daryl Jones, the bassist who began working with the band in 1993, recorded as the Stones. Because if it's a hell of a thing to lose Charlie Watts. Thank God that Charlie and Steve were like this, crosses his fingers. So it was never really any hassle. Charlie Watts said, if I'm not there, put Steve in. So we were sort of under orders. It was important just to get this version of the Stones down on record. Jagger. We had a good track with Charlie, Hit Me in the Head. And we've got other tracks with Charlie too. I keep reading this as Charlie's final appearance. Well, we've got other tracks with Charlie. What is Watts' role in the studio? Richards. He'll say, let's try this one. Let's throw a piano on here, see what happens. Basically, he becomes part of the band. A good producer is usually pretty much the other unseen member of the band. Jagger. Andy and I work together well because we balance each other out. As on Hackney Diamonds, Paul McCartney pops in for a guest spot playing bass on Covered in You, and he and John Lennon co-wrote the Stones' second single, I Want to Be Your Man. Now six decades later, he's in the studio with you. Richards. The Beatles and the Stones. Paul sounds like he's always missed not being in a band, I think, ever since the Beatles broke up. He just loves that camaraderie, that way of doing things, and he's great fun to play with. We go back a long way. Jagger. Paul was next door making the album he currently has this year's The Boys of Dungeon Lane, which is a very good album. It's great. We called Paul in to do two numbers one day because we didn't have a bass player per se. For Paul, he has to write the bass line, but this is a very different song to the one he did on Hackney Diamonds, perhaps a bit more difficult. Paul really liked the song anyway. There are a lot of guests on the album. Jagger. A lot of them don't do much. It's not a big star cameo situation. It's them coming into your world. Bruno Mars, for instance, how did he end up playing cowbell on Never Want to Lose You? Jagger. Every time we got a guest to come and listen to hear the album, because we were probably in the pre-mixing stage by then, we put him to work. You like the song? Go and play something. That's what we did with Bruno. I really love this groove. You play percussion. What do you want to play? Go out and do it. Robert Smith guests on two tracks. He's also on Olivia Rodrigo's album this year. What are your thoughts on her rock music? Jagger. She's really good at it. Everyone thought she was a different kind of singer, but there's quite a few female singers that have made that transition. It's not a permanent transition necessarily, but the ability to change styles from what you think their original girly pop stuff is, it's kind of interesting. What are the songwriting habits like? Do you keep notebooks, record bits on your phone? Jagger. The good thing about writing in a notebook is you have time to think and cross out. You've got your crossings out and corrections. But the advantage of spitting into your phone or your iPad is you don't have any censorship between your head and the pen. You're never censoring it because it's too quick. It's just coming out real spitball fast. Richards. There are a lot of notebooks with little cryptic phrases written down that you're supposed to remember what the hell they meant. And then when you don't, you go through them and make up a whole new meaning. But yeah, there's a lot of jotting things down. Songwriting is really observing. It could just be a phrase that somebody mentions across the bar and something clicks, and it's just a matter of realizing that something's there. Keith, your lead vocal on the album Some of Us is about an amazing woman who has everyone on their knees. Where does a song like that come from? Personal experience? Richards. A little bit of that. The fact is the song has been around. There are several other versions that must be at least 20 years old in the making. Where they come from, I don't know. Whoever she is, she's lost in the mists of time. And he laughs. Is it important to have Keith lead vocal on each Stones album? Richards. No, it's not a fetish. It's just usually I've got one or two and Mick will say, I can't get around that one. You better sing that. And other times I say, this one I'm keeping. I'm going to do this one. Just depends on the song and whether we need another song or not. It's not a forced thing, where's my song? But there's always one or two that crop up and Mick says, this one's yours. The album ends with a Chuck Berry cover, Beautiful Delilah. The Stones' first single was a Chuck Berry cover, too, of Come On. I'm guessing if there were a Mount Rushmore of the Rolling Stone influences, he would be on it. Who else? Jagger. He definitely would be up there. That's a good one. I suppose Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Jerry Lee Lewis, maybe, Little Richard. Richards. Oh, it would have to be Chuck Berry, Muddy Waters, Jimmy Reed, though through the harp of Little Walter Jacobs. And then you go through the old litany of the 50s and 60s and the Chicago blues roster, John Lee Hooker. An amazing period in time, the 50s, for the ways of recording. Jagger. We haven't used tape for ages, but Andy Watt wanted to use tape for Beautiful Delilah. I said, what does it matter? If someone listens to it on their phone, they don't know it was cut on tape. It doesn't make any difference. But we cut it on tape and we did it live. That was old style. Your In the Stars video uses deep fake technology to show what looks like the Stones of yesteryear performing your 2026 single. What was that like to see? Jagger. We had a lot of fun with that. It's only the faces of the musicians that are different. They're not fake people in a fake room. They're all in a room really playing together. The musicians are real musicians that look a bit like the Rolling Stones in 1968. The only thing was the faces. So they worked on mine first, and it kind of looked like me, but not really, like one of my children when they were 23 or something. And then I saw Ronnie, and I said to people working on it, it looks more like Jeff Beck. So they had to do a little extra work. Richards. That's our brushing with AI. I said, very nice. I wish I looked like that now. But maybe that's what they're good for, music videos. Put it in its proper place. It's a cartoon of me younger. Very nice. What's for breakfast? Also, the idea of video and music together. I knew it was a disaster way back in the 70s. You can't shove the ears and the eyes together and say, here it is, look at this. But that's the commercial end of the business, and you duck and dive. The music video became, for a while, more important than the record, which is where it really screwed it up for me as a viable thing. It was just like, have you seen the new video? No, I just made a record. But that's just me being ornery, probably. Artificial intelligence is the new technological innovation. What do you think about AI in music? Richards. My thoughts are, I'd rather hear something original. Music could do a lot better than just trying to copy itself. After all, it's pretty simple stuff. This is not Beethoven or Bach, and I've no doubt AI can do that, but so what? We want new input. We don't want more and more copying and synthesizing. At least that's my point of view. Music is to play around with. Surely there's enough originality without having to copy nursery rhymes. Jagger. Obviously, I don't want to be imitated by AI, vocally and instrumentally, and the band doesn't. I don't want people just putting stuff out there that can sound exactly like the Rolling Stones. I think that's absolutely wrong. If someone wants to make music by AI, go ahead, but it has to be original. You have to have your own input and your own thoughts. There are people who use AI to just make a song from scratch in the style of the Rolling Stones. If you were any kind of creative person, you wouldn't do that. You guys were doing commercial syncs before most major rock bands. You had Start Me Up and the Windows 95 launch. At the time, people gave you some grief for that, but now it's standard practice to have a song in a commercial. Did it bother you guys back then? Jagger. No, we knew we were doing something that was going to be the norm, honestly. Like when we did sponsorship for tours, people said, what is that? I said, well, it's going to become the norm. And this is the total norm. Now, this is America. This is how it works. Richards, it depends. If you're going to sell out, it depends on how you sell out. It can be done with a bit of a tongue-in-cheek. Sometimes it crops up and you say, yeah, that doesn't bother me doing it that way. After all, it is a commercial world. Do you see yourselves touring behind this album or perhaps doing a residency? I don't know at the moment, honestly. I would like to tour. I like touring, like going to people. If it can only be a residency, then it can only be a residency. But the thing about a residency, the only downside for people is it's much more expensive for the further out people that want to come and see the show. Richards, I know that this is all being kicked around. This year, we just decided, look, let's get the record out and let's not rush things. So I see no reason why next year, I don't see anything this year, I can't rush it that much, but I see no reason why next year, good Lord willing, we shouldn't be able to, as you say, maybe a residency something. Maybe you find a different way of taking the thing on the road. Bring the road to us. That's my suggestion. Mr. Charm might be my favorite song on the album. There's a line in it, the darkest days of 1916. Is that a reference to the Battle of Somme in World War I? Mick, are you a history buff? Jagger, Somme or Ypres? I can't remember which. I'm a history buff, but I don't know why it came to me to throw that in there as a seductive line. He laughs. I was just showing off. What are you reading now? Jagger, it's not so much a history, it's an argument between physicists about what happened before the Big Bang. It's a layman's thing. The whole argument is, if we accept that the Big Bang happened, which not everybody does, then what did it come from? Did it come from nothing, or what happened before the Big Bang? There are lots of different scientists with different theories about what this could be. It hasn't been figured out yet, and probably never will. A rock star talking about the Big Bang. If you're not touring a recording, what are you doing on a given day? You wake up, what's next? Richards, wake up is important. That's funny. After that, it depends on the weather. If there's no fixed plans for the day, let's see where the day takes me. I'm spoiled in that way that I can basically turn the day on or turn the day off if I wish. Who's arrived? The grandkids. And we'll get into that area of life. You get beaten up a lot, and he laughs, and that is God's honest truth for grandparents. It's a whole new thing for me. It creeps up on you. You try and get to know them. It's a fascinating thing. Enjoying it very much. That was a very cool behind-the-scenes interview and look at the current status of the Rolling Stones. The two 82-year-old stars, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger, as the first sentence says, they are as vital and creative as ever with a new album that has just come out, and we'll see if they tour or do a residency or what they decide to do next year. Next up is an interesting story about Ted Turner from Sunset Magazine, dated July 21st. Ted Turner's Western Wish. At Vermejo, which is spelled V-E-R-M-E-J-O, the late Ted Turner's vast private wilderness in northern New Mexico, conservation and hospitality converge in an experiment as big as the West itself. The angler crouches low, quietly whipping his fly rod back and forth across the creek that reflects the vivid blue sky. Melting ice pack brings water down from the mountains in the distance through native grass past blooming lavender-hued Rocky Mountain iris. The fly sinks, the line goes taut, and suddenly glinting in the sun is a diminutive but beautiful Rio Grande cutthroat trout, its speckled rose-colored underbelly, which gives the fish its name, glowing crimson in the sun. It's one of mere hundreds, so we admire it briefly before the angler dips his hands into the icy waters and gently releases the fish to swim again. This is Vermejo, a 558,000-acre private wilderness preserve, an all-inclusive resort 40 miles west of Raton near the New Mexico-Colorado border. The nearly 1,000 square miles of alpine tundra, short grass prairie, forests, wetlands, and more are a mosaic of many ecosystems and a sort of private national park. Elk herds drift across valleys. Bison graze where cattle once stripped the grass. Black bears move through the ponderosa forest. Mountain lions patrol the ridges, and at the center of it all is the idea that compassionate capitalism can save the wild American West. To most Americans, Ted Turner, who passed away this spring at the age of 87, will always be the media titan who built CNN and rewired how the world consumes news. But to conservationists and the hospitality industry, Turner is known for something else entirely. At times, he has been the largest private landowner in all of North America, with roughly 2 million acres spread across the United States and Argentina. Beginning in the 1970s, Turner began buying land across the West, massive properties in Montana, Nebraska, New Mexico, and South Dakota that had been worked hard for generations. Many were typical Western cattle operations, overgrazed grasslands, degraded waterways, wildlife pushed aside for livestock. Turner had a different idea. Instead of maximizing short-term profit from cattle, he would attempt something radically different. Restore the ecosystems first, then build a business around their health. Over time, he assembled a constellation of properties, Ted Turner Reserves, including places like Vermejo, Ladder, Armendariz in New Mexico, along with vast properties in Montana. Today, these lands function as a kind of ecological laboratory, part conservation preserve, part luxury wilderness destination. If the model works, the theory goes, the land pays for its own restoration. I recently spent several days there to experience this rare model of conservation-minded luxury hospitality. My guide was Jake McBride, the ineffectuallessly positive president of Ted Turner Reserves, the hospitality arm of Turner Enterprises. We traversed the landscape in a hybrid Ford F-150, taking in the endless sky and vast prairie, pausing to watch bison, mule deer, and the occasional pronghorn, the fastest land animal in North America. Popping a tire here is a rite of passage, says McBride, slowing as we climb a particularly rutted road. Driving through Vermejo feels less like crossing into a separate country. The scale is different to grasp. The preserve stretches more than 30 miles north to south, rising from rolling prairie grasslands into alpine forest that crest above 12,000 feet. Hidden lakes appear in high valleys. Elk trails thread through spruce forests. Two mountain ranges sit inside the property boundary. Rivers can tell you whether land is healthy, says McBride. If the land's healthy, the rivers are healthy. He points to a creek cutting through the valley. That one's recovering. Unlike another creek that looks like a gash cutting through the grass, this one is overgrown with shrubs and little trees that shade the creek, lowering the water temperature to a degree more hospitable for the trout and creating an ecosystem more amenable to beavers who are now damming the streams for the first time in decades. Like much of the American West, Vermejo spent decades under the pressures of extractive ranching, heavy cattle grazing, logging, and land practices that prioritized short-term productivity over long-term health. The results were predictable. Degraded streams, damaged soil, wildlife pushed out of habitat. When Turner acquired the property in 1996, it was a shadow of what it had once been. Restoring it would take decades. The experience of staying on Vermejo is as much about inhabiting Ted Turner's vision as it is about the landscape itself. Guests just don't just check into the lodge. They step into a rarefied version of Western life that blends private residence intimacy with quietly exacting luxury. At Casa Grande, Turner's historic home turned flagship lodge, mornings begin with sunlight pouring through tall windows into a library with double-height ceilings and personal photos of Turner and his friends. A guide might be waiting with saddled horses for a ride across the open prairie, or a fly fishing kit packed for a morning of angling. Others hout out in trucks scanning for elk, bison, and the occasional black bear moving through the folds of the land. Guests can shoot clays, but you never know it back at the lodge, the distances being what they are. There's hiking at higher elevations where the air sharpens, or you can simply find a remote spot and sit still long enough to understand what quiet really feels like. There's a working greenhouse supplying the kitchen, and meals lean into the land. Bison steaks, just harvested vegetables, and regional wines. The rare privilege here is not just comfort, but proximity. To land at scale, to wildlife in motion, and to a version of the West that feels, against all odds, intact. Turner's most famous conservation story involves an animal that once defined the American West, the American bison. Before European settlement, an estimated 30 to 60 million bison roamed the Great Plains. Their migration shaped the ecology of an entire continent. By the late 1800s, industrial hunting and westward expansion had reduced that number to fewer than 1,000 animals. The species came within inches of extinction. As a boy, Turner read about the plight of the bison in National Geographic and told his father he wanted to save them. His father told him he needed to make a lot of money to do that. It's a story Turner kept in his mind as he built his empire. When Turner began acquiring properties in the 1980s, he started introducing bison herds back onto the land, not as spectacle, but as functioning components of a restored prairie ecosystem. Today, his holdings collectively host one of the largest privately managed bison herds in the world, numbering in the tens of thousands. But buffalo, it turns out, were just the beginning. In recent years, Turner's conservation focus shifted to a far smaller creature, the Rio Grande cutthroat trout. Native to the cold mountain streams of New Mexico and southern Colorado, the fish once thrived across thousands of miles of waterways. Over time, habitat destruction, overfishing, and the introduction of non-native trout species pushed the cutthroat into retreat. Today, it survives only in fragments of its historic range. At Vermejo, biologists are working to reverse that trend. Creeks are monitored. Water flows restored. Non-native species removed. Native trout reintroduced. The goal is not simply to protect the fish, but to restore the entire watershed ecosystem that sustains it. Standing beside that small creek, watching the trout vanish back into the current, it's easy to forget how fragile the species has become. The fish swims away, but the story that keeps it alive is much larger. Yes, it's about saving fish, but it's also about saving us. Turner liked to compress big ideas into bumper stickers. In the early environmental era, the message was simple: save the whales. But as he spent decades on the land, restoring rivers, grasslands, and wildlife across his land, the slogan evolved. At one point, he joked that the bumper sticker should really read, "Save the humans," because the entire environmental movement ultimately comes down to our own survival. Today, the trucks and vehicles that crisscross the properties carry the line that best sums up the philosophy behind Ted Turner Reserves: save everything. It's both a joke and a worldview. Once you start thinking in ecosystems instead of individual species, there's really no other logical goal. Today, Vermijo is managed less like a traditional resort and more like a massive ecological restoration project. Teams of biologists track wildlife movement, monitor native vegetation recovery, and study predator-prey dynamics. In some valleys, the land looks as if the last century never happened. But none of it comes cheap. And this is where Turner's model diverges sharply from traditional conservation. The land must pay for its own protection. At Vermijo, that means carefully managed revenue streams, luxury lodging, guided outdoor experiences, wildlife tourism, and regulated hunting. The idea is not to eliminate extraction, but to manage it thoughtfully. A certain number of elk are harvested each year. Bisons are culled to maintain healthy herd sizes. The meat is sold. Late one afternoon, I hiked toward a small gazebo perched on a hilltop. From here, the land stretches outward in every direction. Golden grasslands, dark forest, distant mountain ridges layered into the horizon. The sound? Wind rustling through leaves. My heartbeat. Nothing else. Back at the lodge, a naturalist describes one of the most remarkable features of the property: the KPG boundary layer, a thin geological seam marking the asteroid impact that wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago, runs through Vermijo. It's a reminder that this landscape contains not just centuries of human history, but millions of years of planetary history. The same land where bison graze today once hosted Tyrannosaurus Rex. Standing in the quiet, the time scales begin to blur. Today, the empire Ted Turner built, from media networks to vast land holdings, is gradually transitioning into foundations and nonprofit structures designed to outlast him. The properties are increasingly managed under the umbrella of the Turner Institute of Eco Agriculture, which studies sustainable land practices across the portfolio. The hope is that these lands will remain protected, that the model, conservation funded by thoughtful business, might inspire others to follow. It's an ambitious vision, perhaps an impossible one, but then again, so was saving the buffalo. One afternoon, we wander farther than planned. The trail dissolves into grass. The hills roll outward endlessly. For a moment, it's easy to imagine what this place looked like 200 years ago, before railroads, highways, and barbed wire cut the West into pieces. Eventually, we find our way back. But something about the experience lingers. In an age where almost every landscape is mapped, monetized, and measured, Vermijo offers a rare glimpse of something else: space. Not just physical space, but the possibility of thinking about land differently. McBride tells me a story that I now think of anytime I look out at a vast landscape untouched by the human hand. During a visit with Turner before his health took a steep decline, the mogul turned conservationist insisted on taking one last drive to Vision Quest, the highest point on his Flying D property in Montana. The request came after a difficult afternoon in which Turner, weakened by illness and traveling with nurses, struggled simply to stand. When a nurse suggested he skip the outing, Turner refused. "No," he said, "I need to take Jade to Vision Quest." Assisted by nurses and leaning on a trekking pole, Turner slowly made his way to the vehicle and endured the rough drive to the summit. When they arrived, Turner had one more request. "Jade," he said, "let's walk out to the edge." Eventually, the pair reached an overlook with sweeping views across the lands below. Looking out over the landscape he had spent decades protecting, he turned to McBride. "This is the most exciting spot on all my properties," he said. McBride laughed, thinking Turner was joking. But when he looked down, Turner's eyes were wet with tears. "Don't you think people would like to see this place?" he asked. Then came the charge McBride says guides his work to this day. "We have to share this place with people because it will make better humans out of them." Does Turner's model actually work? Can capitalism, often blamed for environmental destruction, be repurposed as a tool for ecological restoration? Walking through the grasslands of Vermijo, watching elk move across valleys and trout slip through clear streams, it's hard not to feel that something meaningful is happening here. An experiment, a dream, maybe even a blueprint. A month after Turner died, three of the properties were put up for sale to create a fund that will provide the revenue needed to support the education meets hospitality mission of Vermijo and other properties. It will fund the research and conservation efforts. It will continue to refine a model in which travelers can be changed by nature and in turn rehabilitate the nature that nourishes us in profound ways. McBride once heard a guest say how it was so good to be at Vermijo and disconnect. McBride pointed out that connection with nature was actually what she was feeling. It's a visceral and rare thing to be at a luxury resort and know that you're doing something good for the planet and in turn for people. The West has always been a place where big ideas take shape on big landscapes. Ted Turner simply decided to try one of the biggest. And it sounds like he's making a difference, and even after his passing, and for many, many years to come, hopefully. Unfortunately, I wish I could share these pictures with you on video somehow, because it's just gorgeous. You've got a picture of hundreds of bison, the main ranch and the landscape around it. There's a picture of a guy holding a fish. There's Ted Turner and one of his black labs and the furnishings within the house. People are fishing, horseback riding. There's a guy fly fishing here, and it's just amazing. Just the views are just incredible. So anyway, if you ever think about wanting to go out west and do something that's very different, check out Vermijo, which is, again, is spelled V-E-R-M-E-J-O. And I think you'll enjoy a very unique experience of getting back to nature and helping nature get back to where it needs to be. Next, we have a story from Hollywood Reporter dated June 3rd. This is about one of my wife's very, very favorite actors, mine as well. And he's one of those guys who doesn't age. Not sure how that works, but he definitely doesn't look any older than he did 30 years ago when he was in the movie Clueless. "No more Mr. Nice Guy. Okay, sure. Paul Rudd is still Hollywood's most affable everyman. It's just sometimes he really wishes he weren't." By the time Paul Rudd arrived at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts during the early 1990s, he ditched his mother's gold lamé plant pants, but still had a mop of hair plunging down his back, and his sartorial choices hardly screamed everyman. His ambition, serious acting. His air quotes, not mine. Hanging on his wall as inspiration was a rhapsodic review of My Left Foot, which earned Daniel Day-Lewis his first Oscar for playing a guy with cerebral palsy. He was Rudd's favorite actor. Still is, he says, and having watched the film, he was convinced that was exactly the kind of actor that he wanted to be. But as graduation neared, Rudd was invited to sit down with a Hollywood agent. "I wanted to be this dangerous, brooding, incredible actor. Then I have this meeting and she says, 'You're going to need to cut your hair,'" he recalls. He was incredulous at the time. She goes, "Well, you're not an edgy guy, you're more of an all-American type, and they're going to want you clean cut." And I'm like, "Oh my God, that's not who I am. That's the last thing I want to hear." At 57, Rudd has come to terms with who Hollywood wants him to be. In fact, he has built a long and successful career being that guy. And though he's found ways to spackle in considerably darker roles on stage, to which he's retreated whenever he can, his goofy, good guy charisma has fueled 3 decades worth of rom-coms, Clueless, R-rated comedies, I Love You, Man, and most recently, a lengthy spin in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He's been called the MSG of actors by the New York Times, which noted, "You can add Rudd to any movie and the movie will taste better." His next project, Power Ballad, from Sing Street's John Carney, is arguably a departure. Out on June 5th, the film stars Rudd opposite Nick Jonas as an aging musician who never got the rock star life or career that his younger self had envisioned. Instead, he met his wife, had a child, and settled in as the lead singer of The Bride and Groove, Ireland's grooviest wedding band, according to the decal on their van. Rudd took the role in part because he identified with the wistful character. I mean, I don't think I'm completely like what people might think I like. I'm not just a happy-go-lucky dude, he says, then grows quiet. I press for more. Well, I can get pretty depressed, he offers, tentative at first. But we're all multidimensional, right? We all feel things differently. We all get pretty sad about stuff. We all have those moments where you wake up at 3 a.m. and your mind is racing and it's the noise of the world and your life and how am I going to get on with all this? I feel that too. I just don't ever talk about that in interviews. Well, now that he's started, however, on this early May afternoon, Rudd is meeting me at a diner in his Brooklyn neighborhood. He's just back from a few days without his phone, which was purely accidental, he says, but liberating nonetheless. I arrive first and ask the maitre d' which seat Rudd would prefer, to which he laughs. Oh, Paul sits anywhere, he says, the implication subtle but clear. He's not movie star Paul Rudd here. The truth is, Rudd ditched L.A. for the sort of regular guy existence that New York affords right after making Clueless during the mid-1990s. As far as his reps are concerned, it was an astonishingly stupid career move. By the time the coming-of-age comedy captured the zeitgeist and minted Rudd a thinking girl's heartthrob in the summer of 1995, he'd already turned his attention to a stage production of The Last Night of Ballyhoo. Suddenly, he was 3,000 miles from Hollywood and utterly unavailable. My agent was like, "What the fuck are you doing?" he says. But I was so excited. I was 25 or 26, and I was about to be on Broadway. It wasn't even the first time that he'd left his reps baffled by his choices. Rudd had landed a recurring role on the popular drama series Sisters a few years before Clueless, then bailed to study classic English drama at Oxford. It was my first real acting job, and my agent thought I was insane for leaving then, too, says Rudd. Honestly, everyone was like, "You've actually got a job, and now you're going to go back to school to learn to do something to hopefully get a job?" But he wasn't thinking in those terms. Rudd was focused on developing the skills that he'd need for what would hopefully be a long career. All of his heroes had formal training, and he intended to follow in their footsteps. I was also very aware of what I liked and what I found to be moving, so I was looking through the lens of, like, is this something Tom Waits would find cool? Is this something Elvis Costello would do, he says? But as a career moves on, and you age and get more successful, that lens gets cloudier. Between whatever lighthearted comedy Rudd was the face of, he'd work in a play from Neil LaBute or someone else. He loved the tight-knit community and the credibility that the theater provided. People took you a little more seriously, like, "Oh, you're not one of those guys who just lives in L.A. and wants to get famous," he says. And my favorite thing about doing a play, and I used to do one a year, was that it felt so far away from the movie industry, and it was really connecting to what it was that I loved about this. Plus, he didn't have to play the everyman on stage. He was portraying an irresponsible, womanizing alcoholic in a West End production of Long Day's Journey Into Night 25-plus years ago when he met his dear friend Olivia Colman. That this gorgeous, kind, affable person could play against type wasn't a surprise to me, she says of Rudd, who regularly crashed on the floor of her shitty flat in South London during the period. But the theater has always been much more able to see past the hello you give when you walk through the door. In those days, Rudd was equally clear on what he didn't want to do, which included things like pilot season, the annual ritual where hundreds of actors descend on LA to try out for the year's new crop of TV shows. He wasn't interested in the exercise, nor was he eager to get on a series. "I was terrified of landing something that might be visible," he says, "something that might pigeonhole me and make me famous before I really knew enough to be able to sustain a career." He spent the entirety of his early 90s run on the Fox sitcom Wild Oats, scared to death it would become a hit. Spoiler, it lasted only 4 episodes. With hindsight, he says he's grateful for the experience, mostly because it taught him what he didn't want out of his career. "I look back at that kid who was like, 'No, I'm moving to New York and turning down these job offers. My God, I would even audition for things, get them, and then be like, I don't know if I want to do that. and I'm envious of the clarity that I had then, says Rudd, who found other ways to pay rent, including a stint as a bar mitzvah DJ. But I didn't have dependents then. My life and considerations were different, very different. For years, the lock screen on Rudd's phone was the 20th Century Fox logo with the swirling spotlight, and in place of the studio name, three simple words: no one cares. It served as his reminder not to take any of this too seriously. The gig, the upset, the competition. 99% of the world doesn't give a fuck about the movie industry anyway, he says. They don't even see these things. At the same time, Rudd has been chasing one form of acceptance or another for as long as he can remember. He believes it began when his younger sister was born, and suddenly he was vying for the attention of his ad industry mom and airline executive dad. I realized if I could do a little dance or something, they'd say, oh, look at our kid. And I liked that, so I just kept doing it, he says. And that's what I'm still doing. It has nothing to do with the craft. You're just doing whatever you can to get people to like you and say, you're cute, you're funny, you're doing a good job. As the new kid in Kansas City, Kansas, and arguably the only one in class with British-born Jewish parents, Rudd found that humor was the quickest route to acceptance. By the time he moved to L.A. for acting school, he had added other colors. Adam Scott, who was 2 years behind him, insists that everyone there seems to understand that Rudd was poised for stardom. And not just because he had landed a Nintendo commercial right out of school, though that was a big deal. I was at the premiere of Clueless out in Malibu with him, and it comes up on this big screen on the beach, and immediately I was like, oh, Paul's going to be a famous person now, says the Severance star, who remains one of Rudd's closest friends. And sure enough, everything changed after that. The velvet ropes parted. Suddenly, we could just walk into any bar. It was like, whoa, what the fuck is going on? This is incredible. Despite its impact on his career, Rudd didn't fight for his role in Clueless. In fact, he was considerably more interested in playing Cher's clearly gay love interest, Christian, or Dion's boyfriend, Murray. He hadn't realized the latter was written as a black character. As for the former, I remember reading it like, wait a minute, this is a gay character, who's also the coolest character in the movie. I've never seen this before, and it's the most interesting part, he says. The director, Amy Heckerling, let him read for that role, as well as for Cher's older, nerdier ex-stepbrother turned loved interest, Josh, which is the one he landed. But after the audition was done, he says, I was not on the phone with my agents like, did I get it? Did I get it? It would be several more years before Rudd found a film that spoke to his sensibilities, which happened with Wet Hot American Summer. I know Clueless was funny, but this was my kind of funny, he says, of the 2001 entry, a parody of 80s-era summer camp and teen sex comedies. He felt it the minute he read the script, and his instincts were validated when he arrived in an actual summer camp to make the movie with a group that included Amy Poehler, Bradley Cooper, and Molly Shannon. Wet Hot didn't hit the way Clueless had, but it led to more comedies, including Anchorman, which Rudd says he obsessively chased in a way he'd never chased anything before. He didn't even care what role he landed in the irreverent Will Ferrell comedy, so long as he was part of the cast. I don't really fight for many things, says Rudd, but I was a nuisance in my desperation to be part of that, and at a certain point I think I just wore them down. If Clueless made Rudd a heartthrob, Anchorman secured his spot in what became comedy's new Brat Pack, alongside actors like Steve Carell, Seth Rogen, and Jason Segel. I'm not the one people are really talking about, Rudd argues, but it's like I'm always kind of there. Judd Apatow, the pack's unofficial leader, was so charmed by Rudd, who he says has this ability to play it completely straight and it can be rough and even heartbreaking, but also really funny at the same time, that he put him in his feature directorial debut, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which came out the following summer. Apatow's only request is that Rudd put on weight for the role. I told him, if you're gorgeous, I don't think it works as well. But then a week into filming, the studio had a bunch of notes, and one of them was, why is Paul Rudd so overweight? Translation, Rudd is allowed to be funny so long as he still looks like Josh from Clueless. More cult comedies followed. Knocked Up, I Love You Man, and Our Idiot Brother among them. Hard R laughs was not exactly the path that Rudd envisioned for himself, but he was having a blast. In fact, he just kept saying yes to the next project and then the next one, and suddenly comedy was his lane. And it's not like I had all these job offers for that serial killer part, he jokes. So maybe that agent was right. Maybe I don't have any edge and this is what I was meant to do. But it's also weird, sometimes with comedy, it's looked at as a little more frivolous than the important movies and the important actors. Does that ever bother him? Nah, I made peace with that a hell of a long time ago, he says. I don't give a shit. He stops himself, pauses. I shouldn't say that. Another pause. I mostly don't give a shit. Then the hint of a smile. Part of me gives a shit. In case this isn't obvious, a Marvel superhero was never on Rudd's vision board. In fact, he still finds it a tad absurd that he, the self-described avatar for averageness, was cast as one, though Marvel boss Kevin Feige insists he had everything that Ant-Man, a wisecracking thief turned reluctant hero, required. We needed this guy to be a criminal, but also someone that you're rooting for no matter what, and that's Paul, says Feige. He's also funny and good-looking and unbelievably charismatic. Still, Rudd says he didn't sign on because he was eager to be in a Marvel movie. For me, it was the Edgar Wright angle, he says. At the time, the British auteur was attached to direct the film, which he'd been developing for years already. And I was excited, like, you mean the Shaun of the Dead guy is doing this and he wants me to be in it? Okay, this I can do. This is my lane. Then it obviously changed pre-production, but that was the overriding thought I had. Rather than drop out with Wright, which per Feige had been a very real concern, Rudd not only stuck with the project, but recruited his Anchorman director, Adam McKay, to help him do a pass on the script. The thought I had was, if this can be a thing that really works and people see it, maybe it will help me get some interesting smaller things financed, and I can have a little more control over what comes after it, says Rudd. His only prior experience with anything of that scale and global reach was playing Phoebe's boyfriend on Friends, but he was simply a recurring guest star then. For the first time in Rudd's life, he had to get into Marvel shape, which meant cutting out anything enjoyable diet-wise and a punishing exercise regimen. The results played into a popular narrative that Rudd seems to be aging in reverse. I'm beginning to look like I could be his mom, says Coleman, who's 5 years his junior. It's really fucking annoying and he won't share his secrets. Rudd insists he has none. I'm a withering 80-year-old man on the inside, he jokes, and I'm catching up on the outside, too. What Rudd had not anticipated was the degree to which the next decade of his life would be spent either making or promoting a Marvel film. His first foray as Ant-Man led to 2 more standalone films and 3 Avengers movies, including the forthcoming Avengers Doomsday, where Feige said he plays more of an elder statesman now, dealing with other newer characters. Ant-Man even has his own theme park attraction at Hong Kong Disneyland. Rudd was there alongside Feige for its opening. As he had hoped, he's been able to get other things made. Sure, there were more big studio franchise swings, including a pair of Ghostbuster films. Life is sometimes just collecting experiences, he says. But he also put his muscle behind smaller projects, including a few A24 films, Friendship and Death of a Unicorn, along with Mute, a Duncan Jones sci-fi drama that he did largely because he finally got to play a deeply menacing character. Some work better than others, though Rudd is way too nice to start rattling off the ones that he regrets. I think Tina Fey said it best when she was like, sometimes you do something and you thought the script was great and it really works, and then you're watching it and all of a sudden the credits come up and you go, wow, that one shrunk in the wash, he says, and shrugs, I've been in several things that have shrunk in the wash. Our waiter has just come by to pour a fresh cup of black coffee, Rudd's third in as many hours. He'll pay for the caffeine blast later, but he's between projects right now and has nowhere to be, which seems to genuinely thrill him. For someone who works as much as Rudd does, he's quite content not working. The height of joy for me is having everyone I love under the same roof, maybe taking a walk around this amazing city, and then getting into bed at 8 or 9 at night and watching Antiques Roadshow with my wife, he says. And he laughs. I mean, my God, people don't think I age? Listen to me. Now that his kids are grown, his daughter Darby is 16, his son Jack is 21, he's planning to do another play, his first in more than a decade. Rudd had stopped when life got busy, and his kids, who were young at the time, took issue with their father's absence. In fact, he can still conjure the heartbreak look on his daughter's face as she asks, Daddy, do you really have to go back to the theater again tonight? And now she'd be like, I don't give a fuck, I've got homework, says Rudd. But before a play or any other project, he's got to get out the word for Power Ballad. He had a ball making the movie. It's this part, the selling of it, that doesn't come naturally or even comfortably. It all feels so inauthentic, which makes him crazy. I really just want to be a respected actor, he says, and I want people to think I'm good. Well, I want to be in things that people think are cool. I want to be the kind of actor that were always my favorite actors growing up. So I ask, does he feel that he's achieved that? I don't know, he says, pausing again. I don't dwell on it. As he was making Power Ballad, Connie says it became clear. Paul really doesn't consider himself a big movie star. He considers himself a jobbing actor who just happens to have that face. But as the director notes, it was only once Rudd signed on to the project that other actors got interested, the money suddenly got released, and the Irish Film Board came on board. He is, whether he can see it or not, the draw. Still, Carney empathizes. There's a version of each of us out there that didn't quite work out the way the weird, policing, 20-year-old version of ourselves thought, he says. I mean, anytime I get called a crowd-pleasing film director, my 20-year-old self goes, what happened? I thought you were going to be the next Jean-Luc Godard. Apatow caught an early screening of the movie, in addition to being impressed by Rudd's musical talent. Yes, that's him, really him singing and playing guitar, which per Jonas felt effortless and excellent from the first day on the set. He was thrilled by the dramatic opportunity that the role offered his pal. When you watch it, you feel the entire history of frustration of this performer, and Paul's great at carrying that pain, says Apatow. So sure, he can do all the lighter colors, but like so many great comedians, we sense that there's more going on there, and the darker sides of his personality are what make him fascinating to watch. Despite glowing reviews, it's impossible to predict whether anyone will go see Power Ballad in theaters, which is less a commentary on the film than it is the increasingly fragmented state of the entertainment industry. Regardless, it's the kind of movie that Rudd wants in the world right now. I just want to feel fucking hopeful. And the thing I love about John Carney's films is that you come away from them like, God, that was a really emotional ride and it moved me, he says. But there's also joy in it. And I'm seeking that out more now than ever because of the crushing weight of everything else that is so overwhelmingly shitty. He looks up from his coffee cup. I do want to be optimistic. I do want to laugh. I do want to not be serious about certain things, he says, and then stops himself. He smiles. It's almost as if Paul Rudd wants to be the guy that you think he is, too. What a great article about Paul Rudd and his career and his newest movie, again, called Power Ballad with Nick Jonas, of all people. So if you haven't had a chance to see that, I would recommend it. I think it's probably on streaming by now. But take a look at Power Ballad and any of the other films that Paul Rudd has been in. He's made probably 80% of the movies he's been in have been really, really good. And there's a few that aren't so great. I don't think Death of a Unicorn is a movie people are going to be flocking to, but there's a lot of movies he's been in all the way back to Clueless 30 years ago. That's it, folks. We'll bring you the Men's Hour again next Friday. In the meantime, please listen to all the great programming available to you right here on Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Take care.